CliffCentral.com.
Simon Sebag Montefiore is a British historian, television presenter, and the author of a number of very, very popular history books and some novels. And I'm thrilled to have him on for the second time, because the last time we spoke to him, it was for our podcast series on history called Blind History. And we spoke about some of the books that he's already written. But my goodness, do we have a reason to talk to him today. First of all, Simon, what a pleasure to see you. And thank
great
you for making some time for us.
Great to be back with you and to talk again.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, first of all, congratulations on this volume, which is absolutely, I mean, you know, people talk about, well done on your book. And, you know, you say that especially to a first time author and they go, oh, thank you so much. And, but my God, this is a magnum opus. I mean, this is really quite something.
Thank you.
You've written the history of the world, and it is nothing short of a phenomenon. And by the way, congratulations, because I saw on your Instagram that it is the Times History Book of the Year, which is another good reason to buy it and look at it and read it this Christmas, because quite apart from being very beautiful, it contains the most wonderful and beautiful stories. I just love the idea that you essentially decided to tell the story of history through families.
That's right. That's right. I mean, what I wanted to get was I wanted to write a book that combined the span of world history with all the sort of huge movements, the advances in technology, the convergences and divergences, and at the same time that had the intimacy, the grit, the juice, if you like, of biography. And it occurred to me that a family history of the world might work. And so I embarked on this somewhat insane but actually delightful project that's really been an amazing experience to write.
Well, you have written a number of very, very successful books already, but this one is probably, just judging by how much work must have gone into it, this is probably your biggest project to date, I'm sure.
Oh, by far. I mean, it's by far the biggest project I'll probably ever do in my life. And like I said, you know, when I embarked on it, I sort of realized that it was going to be bigger than I thought and harder than I thought. I mean, writing all books is hard, but this was especially challenging because it's all one narrative. So everything had to sort of fit in and link up. And so it was a daunting prospect, but also really satisfactory. And as it turned out, of course, it's for the readers to decide if they enjoy it. But it worked. It is one narrative. It does all hang together. And the style of doing it is original. I mean, no one's done this before. And I was going to ask you, actually.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen history presented in this way before. And obviously, you're an experienced hand at telling stories. And you've done the most incredible work, particularly on Russian history, which I've absolutely loved every step of the way. And I most recently read your book on Jerusalem, which I also adored. And here, this is probably the most ambitious task anyone could wish to tell, because it's the story of humanity from its earliest origins in terms of King Sargon, for heaven's sake, and the Ziggurat of Ur. But how long did it take you to start putting this together? I mean, there's a picture that you also shared of you in between just thousands of books in your office, which you must have had to, you know, kind of almost wind your way like a labyrinth through. how long did it take you, and how much reading and research did you have to do? As experienced and powerful of a historian as you yourself are, and how much must already be in your head? I mean, this looks like a lot of source material.
Yeah, well, that picture really catches it. By the way, that's a South African leopard's head there from my last trip in South Africa, which I love. And so I keep it there as a sort of paperweight on top of a heap of books on Africa. but yeah, I mean, the way that office catches the sort of chaos and the sort of, you know, one has to master an enormous number of subjects to sort of get something like this off the ground. And it's like, sort of, you know, one has to sort of go one reads for each subject. So each of those piles of books in that photograph are a subject, geographical area, like, you know, but they're like ancient Egypt or southern central Africa in the 19th century, or the Arab world or whatever, Britain, America, you know, Cambodia, you know, whatever. And, you know, so what I did in each thing was I read the general histories on those subjects, but then I tried to get into the academic and scholarly stuff so that I could bring a new take on many of many subjects. And but of course, by the end, I could barely get into my office or out of it. I mean, it's all still here, in fact, around me now. I have to sort of almost crawl into this office I'm just sort of, you can see down here, you can see that it's all still a terrible mess.
Amazing.
But as the picture shows, you know, it's just an extraordinary experience doing this. And, you know, I really enjoyed it actually. But there were times I felt I didn't sleep for about 3 years.
Well, did you feel at the end almost a sense of relief, or was it so much fun doing it? Because you do love reading and understanding and researching history. It's part of what makes your own writing so charming, and you make it easy for the rest of us to think we're discovering things anew. And, you know, there is that scholarly and academic stuff, which most of the pedestrian historians don't really get to participate in, some of it in languages that are no longer spoken, and from source documents that are in, you know, museums and airtight libraries where they no longer see the sun, or, you know, have to be observed with gloves. Yeah. And you must have got your hands dirty a little bit there too. It also strikes me as always interesting. Sorry, answer that question before I bring in more. Yeah.
No, the, I mean, the whole fun, or the, is, or the, I mean, or the whole actual fun, process. Yeah, I mean, the whole fun of it was just, you know, it was just entering all these new worlds and working on sort of, you know, working on them, penetrating them, immersing oneself in them, and then deciding I've got enough to do that. You know, I've got enough on that subject. Now I need to get on to the next subject. And so the way I work is like I master a subject and then I move on. So by the time I start writing, the idea is that I can sort of, I know where everything goes and where it's sort of, and if I've got enough on it. But obviously in this case, I was continually finding new books were coming out all the time. I had to read them all and add them and encompass them into the book. So it was a lot of fun. But in answer to your question, was it a relief? It's the biggest relief. Just seeing you holding the book is just the greatest joy. To think that the book actually exists. There were times when I thought I'd never complete it, because once I'd started it, I realized it was so ambitious and so big. That I was going to be, it was, you know, would I ever finish it? I sometimes wondered if I really would. And it's just a joy to see it in your hands. Yeah. Holding it up, and I'm very proud of it. And it's such a relief. I can sort of feel like, you know, I feel like, I can relax this Christmas.
Well, I hope that, everyone who's listening to this is inspired already to buy it. I mean, it did your publishers put any kind of, preconditions on it for you? I mean, it has to be this long, or it has to be, because you must have reached a certain page count and gone, oh, I wonder if I've overdone this, or maybe they're going to try and edit it down and remove some of the stuff that I really loved putting in. You can't get too attached, can you?
No, I mean, you've got to be really ruthless. You've got to be able to drown kittens. And But actually, it could be as long as a book could be, but no longer, obviously, because I wanted it to be in one volume. So that was the sort of limit. But the thing is that they didn't try and limit me, because the point is there are lots of short histories of the world, and there are also, you know, long, rather sort of textbooky kind of histories of the world, and this is neither of those. And as for length, you know, it's funny because people say, oh, is it quite long? Well, it's the same length as the latest book of biography of Winston Churchill. And it's the same length as the latest biography of umpteen American presidents. There's a new book about President Ulysses Grant, U.S. Yeah. Grant. There's a new book about President Woodrow Wilson. They're exactly the same length as this. And this book has biographies of all of those people in it as well. So it's actually the right length for what I wanted to do.
But it must have been very difficult to decide how much to keep in and how much to leave out, because in some of these stories, especially the ones that you know best and that you love best, there must have been a temptation to tell a little bit more than, you know, almost to give everybody equal time. It must have been a very, very difficult thing to do. And I don't like to compare authors, but I've always said that one of the most extraordinary achievements of someone like Yuval Noah Harari is that he managed to condense what is an extremely complicated and pithy and full life's work in terms of studying history into a single book. And you have the same ability, which is almost more impressive than your already well-known abilities as a historian, to be able to say, I'm going to just include this much. I'm not going to include all of this. I'll give you the gist.
That's right. I mean, you know, I really thought hard about each subject, and I thought, you know, first of all, what is the, you know, what is the essence of this? I mean, first of all, I had to decide what to use as the tether for an important subject, whether it's, you know, new technologies or the, you know, the Black Death or whatever. Who was I going to use as my tether? Because that's the idea. That's the idea behind the book, is anyone can read this book. You don't have to know anything. It's totally accessible. It can be regarded as an entertainment, but also it has the scholarship underneath it and beneath it, and that provides a sort of framework that if you want, if you're serious about historiography, then you can find a new take, an up-to-date take, a challenging take that challenges the conventional wisdom if you want. But I don't. What I do in the book is I don't sort of lecture. I don't polemicize. I really follow the kind of rules, show and tell, and it can be read by anybody. And then, you know, then I just try and get to the essence of the subject, usually through the people. And the people can be a family, an individual, a woman, a man, a child, somebody who, some group of people, a coterie of people that made the, you know, changed the world or linked to this development. And that's the really fun thing. So, you know, I really hope to sort of bring alive these people. And that's the great challenge of all historians, isn't it? But I think Harari's book is great. This is very different. That's sort of anthropological. That really is about the species. Mine is the opposite, if you like. It's the antidote to that. And in fact, the Financial Times just reviewed it this weekend and said exactly that. They said, you know, one of the criticisms of Jared Diamond, Guns, Germs, and Steel. And of Harari's Sapiens, is that they're sort of actual individuals are too far removed for it. And it says this is the antidote to it. And that's exactly what I wanted it to be. It's literally the antidote to those two brilliant books. And of course, there's no point in reinventing the wheel. They've done those books brilliantly. But this is a book that I was sort of born to write.
Did you feel any pressure to give equal time? I mean, you really do go all over the world, and you cover some people in history who I am embarrassed to admit I didn't know anything about, which I think is terrific. I mean, what's the point of reading something that you already know? But there were stories about people and about families and about events and about things that occurred in history that we would have all been fascinated to know that I had no idea had occurred. And it is thanks to this tour that we do through time and through, you know, all these different places on the planet. Did you feel pressure to have to make it all kind of the same?
No pressure. You know, no pressure at all, because I've always wanted to write exactly this book, funny enough. But obviously, you know, in the last 10 years, history's changed a bit, and it's now expected that there's much more diversity. There's much more about women and women's history. And all those things are brilliant developments, which are huge improvements, because actually it was far too European. It was far too, you know, centered on men, European men often, or North American and European men. But what's great about doing families is, you know, they're very, you know, families can be as diverse as you like. And all families are a product of some sort of hybridity, some mixture of peoples and places and times. And so actually, it's just suited this perfectly. So, yeah, I mean, I wanted it to be as diverse as possible. And what I decided really early on, and this applies to, you know, this covers your part of the world, is that you know, it was going to be families. I decided to do something which hadn't really been done before, which is to treat the Zulu royal family or the ruling families of Benin or the Mali or the Ghanas, to treat all those families exactly as I would treat the Rothschilds, the Habsburgs, the Ottomans, or, you know, the dynasties that we're used to, the Windsors. And so that's what I've done. So you really do get, you really are, you know, they are treated exactly the same way. And the same with different parts of the world. There's just as much Africa as there is Europe. And there's an enormous amount on Asia in this book. But I just sort of wanted to judge what was important, you know, what I felt was important, and also what's interesting. And it's got all the sort of familiar characters that, you know, you'd expect, you know, from Mandela to Churchill to Frederick the Great to Nebuchadnezzar and Cleopatra. But it also is, the whole point of it is, it's full of people that, you know, you probably don't know about. I didn't know about a lot of them beforehand. So that's been the great joy of it for me.
Yeah, there is this temptation, though, among historians to almost rank things, you know, how they you know, and it has been the case since the dawn of time. We call this person Alexander the Great, as opposed to Alexander, who was also a king and who also did some conquering, you know. So there's this temptation to kind of look at everything through this lens of history. And then, of course, as far back as you can go, it becomes more mysterious, and therefore they probably have more superhuman abilities, or they look to be more impressive. And of course,
that's right.
With with the perspective of much less time, we tend to be a lot harder on people. You know, today is the day, actually, almost, I think, 9 years ago to the day that Nelson Mandela died. And already you're getting these hagiographies and these, you know, these biographies about him where he wasn't this and he wasn't enough of that. And we haven't even seen 9 years go by yet.
Yeah. I think that's the point. I mean, you know, in this book, you know, you'll find these kind of great brand names of history, but I treat them slightly differently. I mean, Alexander the Great is a good example. I mean, he was an astonishing personality. Though there's lots that we don't know. But at the same time, you know, I place him and his family in the Macedonian Argead dynasty. So you kind of meet his family from much, you know, a couple of centuries before he's even born. And, you know, when you deal with him, you just realize, like, he was this kind of pretty ferocious sort of warlord, you know, probably a pretty thuggish character. And certainly, you know, he killed a lot of his own sort of closest friends. And so when you look at the evidence, like, he's kind of less perfect than he's usually treated. And I'm sure the same is true with later characters, you know, the Mandelas or the Thatchers, the Gorbachevs, and so on. All of them are in this book. And the whole point is just to reassess them and treat them like they're humans. And, you know, in my own life, I've been lucky because I've known quite a lot of these kind of some titanic figures, some politicians in all sorts of countries, and they've read my books. And through that, I've got to know them, or I've covered them in some way as a war correspondent or whatever. And, you know, I've brought that to the book as well. So the last 50 years has quite a lot of these people. But the one thing you realize is that, you know, often politicians just get lucky, or they get unlucky, you know, and you know, they're actually, you kind of get it, you kind of realize that that many of them are pretty ordinary people, just in extraordinary situations. And of course, we end the book with Putin and Zelensky, who are both examples of that in a way.
Well, I mean, I will save that question for a little bit later on, because that's an ongoing story and something which you understand from a historical perspective probably better than anyone I'll get to talk to in my life. So I'll hear from you in a moment about that, if we can save that for right at the end. But you also wrote this during COVID, which, I mean, when COVID came along, obviously we were all thinking, oh no, this is the worst thing that could happen. And we were all mostly nervous about how badly it would affect us, the ones we love, our countries, all the rest of it. But there must have been some small part of you that went, aha, this is what I've been waiting for in order to approach a subject and a project of this enormity. Thank you very much. I'll start now.
It wasn't quite like that, but actually it was a kind of blessing for me, because I'm just not sure I could have ever written this in any other time, because, you know, my family were in the country. I was in London in this office, you know, working away, and I literally you know, it was like a mafia, in the those mafia movies, like when they go to the mattresses, you know, they just kind of camp in a house with sort of shotguns and wait for, you know, during one of those mafia. It was a bit like that. I sort of went to the mattresses, you know, I was living, right. I was just living for this book. I was like going to sleep at a sort of certain time, getting up at dawn, working all day, then going for a run or trying to do some exercise and sort of do, you know, but I was like total immersement, total obsession. And that's the only way to get these giant projects done. And as for the COVID, you know, actually, I mean, at the time when I was writing it, I happened to start on literally the day of the first lockdown in 2020. I think it was March or the end of February, March. And, you know, and actually I sort of quickly realized that actually this was a kind of, in a way, useful for me. It was a great time for writers actually, just to sort of be writing because it was so intense and focused. But also, you know, obviously pandemics and epidemics and plagues played a big part in world history. And so that really concentrated the mind. We were living through one, and that was interesting. And I was planning to end the book on the day the first person died in Wuhan of COVID. But then, of course, Ukraine happened, and that changed it. And then I already had a lot of Ukraine and Russia in the book, obviously, because those are subjects that are close to my heart and are very important. It's one of the ironies, isn't it, that, you know, half of the academic world now is concentrating on sort of writing about imperialism and colonialism, and yet that none of them were writing about an actual empire that was actually malignly expanding and planning expansion right now, right in front of them, and none of them noticed it. Anyway, that's as it is. But I then changed the end of the book so that it ended on the day of the invasion.
So let's since we're in this territory already, but Russia's had this series of calamities, and now, you know, once again the people of that part of the world are plunged into a war of, you know, whatever making, the making of a megalomaniac or whatever reason you choose, because it's all, to most people, immaterial what started it, but they're in it. And the people of the Ukraine and the people of Russia now are forced to sacrifice their children and grandchildren and their economies and their lives and this, the way that they live, for yet another conflict. Do you think Russia's particularly unlucky, especially having looked at the whole world in your book? Or do you think that that they've just earned a reputation for that because of the way that they've dealt with it?
Well, I think Russia's unusual in that it is a country that was founded as an empire. You know, Peter the Great founded the Russian Empire, gave it the name Russia, you know, really comparatively recently. Because, you know, when we look at the world, we think everything's been around forever. Of course, it hasn't. Russia, you know, he founded Russia in the 1720s, really. And he founded it as an expansive empire. And it hasn't really changed its view of itself and the world radically since. It hasn't found a way to go beyond that vision. All the other countries in the world have, maybe except China. But so that mindset has, you know, it hasn't really changed. I mean, obviously there was sort of, the Soviet Union was of course radically different in many ways, but it also adopted that messianic sort of mission to the world, but adapting it to Marxism-Leninism, encompassing Marxism-Leninism with it. And then the Putin regime has adapted parts of both those regimes as well, and added to it a sort of ultra-nationalism, which is very up, very modern. So for the Russian people, you know, they haven't really gone beyond this quite aggressive vision of what the Russian state is. And of course, it doesn't mean that Russia's only destined to be this sort of country. I mean, there's no reason why one day Russia shouldn't be a democracy like anywhere else. But equally, the Russian state itself, you know, maybe it will fall apart. You know, maybe it will disintegrate if this war fails, and it looks like it's going to. Maybe this will finally cure it of its imperial persona, which has never managed to shake off so far.
Does it strike you as interesting or annoying that so many people have a very simplistic view of history. They tend to think, well, if I can just get you to this point in history, then you'll understand why my version of whatever happened afterwards is a better version than someone else's. And you see this all over the world. You know, if we could just blame imperialism, if we could just blame conquest, if we could just blame cultural suppression and cultural kind of submission. You know, we look at ancient Rome. Many of the nations and the families that you cover in your book are guilty of all kinds of dreadful things. And depending on where you take it back to, you can quite conveniently blame some of those along the way. Where if you did a more nuanced approach to the whole thing, you'd have a lot harder time ascribing guilt.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, guilt is an interesting subject in history. I mean, first of all, you know, history that's fitted into any kind of straitjacket of ideology isn't history, it's polemic. And so, you know, we were brought up with a certain vision in Britain of sort of Britain's sort of, you know, philanthropic role in world history. And that was an ideology. But now academia is dominated by a vision that all sort of, you know, especially British empires are sort of incredible, vast criminal enterprise. That's also an ideology, and that's equally wrong. And so in this book, for example, I just try and come, you know, I try and find as close as I can to what I think is the right approach. And that includes, you know, approaching the, looking at the world in the whole, that's the whole point of global history, but also just not following conventional wisdom about guilt. I mean, I do think one has to show victims, whoever they are. That means, you mentioned hierarchies earlier, that means not having a hierarchy of victims and of goodies and baddies, for example. Mm. I mean, I think that you know, everyone counts or no one counts. So in this book, I try and show as many people who are killed by Asian leaders as I do by European leaders, for example, you know, in the history of India, and the same in Africa. Right. So I think that's kind of important. Everyone counts or no one counts. And I try and follow that rule in this book. I try not to be controlled by any ideology. But equally, there are things, it's impossible to completely divorce oneself from the present and the obsessions of the present. For example, you know, there's a lot about empire in this book, but not just the British Empire, the French Empire, the Dutch Empire, the Zulu Empire, you know, mm-hmm. other empires that are also important. And at the same time, you know, we're very obsessed with slavery now. Well, that's a very important subject that was neglected a long time. So there's a lot about Atlantic slavery, the vast crime of Atlantic slavery. But at the same time, we look at other slaveries that were just as enormous. And, you know, no one really studies that. You know, they should be studied much more widely. So that's, for example, you know, Mediterranean slavery, African slavery is a huge subject.
Even the kind that is still going on to this day.
Yeah.
It's this, and the cover of your book, I've got to just compliment you on that, because if there's ever been an attempt to kind of show a whole lot of cultural and in a very small space, it's beautifully done. It also can serve just as well as that leopard head that you've got as a paperweight, which when I wasn't reading it in my office, it's been sitting there, and I sort of want to display it. It's a nice book to show people.
Good. I mean, well, yeah, I worked really hard on the cover because I had a vision of the cover. I didn't want it to look like any other book that's ever been. And you very rarely see on history books those African and Brazilian colors.
With the Chinese dragons and the Ottoman sort of mosaic background. It's beautiful.
That's right. So that's sort of captures some of the nature of the book and the breadth of its approach.
So you said something interesting just now about the, you know, being able to sort of talk about who killed, but very often history is just the story of the victors and the story of the battles. And what I liked about this is that even right at the beginning, you talk about King Sargon's daughter and, you know, what was done to her. And later on to Boudicca and many others along the way. And the story of these women who history just says, oh, well, you know, she was conquered. She was taken out by this guy. And they spend much more time talking about the guy. And I think one of the benefits of being around now is that there is this emphasis on the stories that were less well told, the stories that were less about grandiosity, more about human experience.
That's right. I mean, that's the fun thing about one of the great things about family history is the history of women. And that's one of the great, really positive developments of this new history. And of course, you know, women are hugely important in families, you know, clearly biologically, but also, you know, they came to power in family, in dynasties, and they became hugely important. Sometimes they arrived as slaves, as enslaved persons. Sometimes they came to power as the wives or widows or mothers of powerful people, princes. But the whole fun of this book, and you know, one of the things I'm proud of is the number of women shown in the book, introduced in the book. And like you said, some of them are Boudicca and Cleopatra and Margaret Thatcher and Indira Gandhi. But some of them are an Idia of in Benin and so on. But some of them are women that you won't have heard of, and we all should have heard of them. And so, you know, they play huge roles in this book. And it really, I mean, I suppose the surprise of it is, if it is a surprise, is that, you know, they're no better than the men, actually.
I was going to say those Julia Claudian women, I mean, Messalina and Agrippina, and these were not very nice people.
No.
they were in some ways more ambitious even than the men in those stories.
Yeah. I mean, there are certain families, or, you know, where to be a character in that family, to be a player, you have to play the game of politics, whether you're a man or a woman. And you know, in systems of personal power, you know, the fight for power is absolute and very personal. And I think that's one of the themes of the book. And you see that all over the world today, just as you always have.
When you talk about the themes of the book, apart from the family and the individual stories, it does seem to me that there's sort of this play on whether or not women and men have the same approach to power, and whether men and women have the same approach to history even. Did you come to any profound conclusions after studying these people in such great detail and weaving this tapestry together?
Just that they have the, you know, they have the same approach. I mean, there are all sorts of themes about family within the book. I mean, one is the influence and the importance of powerful mothers, and you know, another, I mean, on families themselves, I mean, you know, you obviously one sort of looks at family in detail here. I mean, of course, the biological family we all have, in some ways, we're all part of dynasties. That's the great thing about family history. And that's, you know, this fashion for looking into family histories now. You know, this book is very much part of that. But in terms of families with our surnames and, you know, and the idea of primogeniture or a family with the name of a dynasty. I mean,
here in Africa, tribe, and how important that clan, tribe, language, cultural identities become.
That's all really, I mean, that's all very much part of the book. And, you know, one of the interesting things that's happening, you know, now is in much of the world, you know, family connections, family power families, are coming back, and it looked like they were going to vanish forever. And, you know, all the states, all the new states in Africa, for example, and in Asia, post-colonialism adopted the structures of American democracy, sometimes British democracy, but they kind of had a presidency, elections, legislatures. But actually a lot of them, became sort of effectively autocracies or monarchies. And if you look at the world, especially in Asia today, you know, family, you see dynastic reversion, you know, you see powerful families, you know, taking control again. And that's because states have failed to deliver the kind of security and justice that people expect. And they can get it, they feel they can get it most from their tribe, from their clan, from their dynasty.
There seems to be a little disappointment in democracy at the moment. And we had a new Zulu king enthroned just this year, the seventh or eighth in line from King Shaka, who you also cover in your book beautifully. It does seem to me that there is this, but then history is also, you know, the old medieval Wheel of Fortune, that, yeah, you know, the king climbs on, and as he's in the ascendant, then he's sitting enthroned and in all his glory at the top, and then falls from grace and is eventually, you know, trampled underfoot. This is the story of so many nations and so many families and so many individuals all over the world, isn't it?
That's the whole point of the book, really. It's that, it's that you put your finger on it. I mean, no one, even the victors, no one stays on top for long. It's a relentless game of power. And, you know, we look at it both in terms of little families and, but also in terms of great powers and empires and states, and none of them last for long. And I think, you know, one rule is, though, about empires is that the more tolerant they are, the more open they are, the longer they last. So, you know, the Roman Empire, which made everybody in the empire a citizen, lasts 1,000 years almost. You know, the Nazi Empire in Europe in World War II lasts 4 years because, you know, they exclude so many people with such brutality. So if there's any lesson, that's one of the lessons, that tolerance really pays in matters of state. But, you know, but you're right. I mean, you know, we cover many victors, but one of the things I wanted to do was not to have this as a victor's history. So though it's got all the great powers and famous kingdoms that you'd have heard of, has the Zulus, of course, has many African realms and kingdoms and families. But it also has, and of course it has Russia and America and the British Empire and the French Empire and the Chinese Empire, but it also has lots of smaller countries that people don't normally read about, the Albanians and the Cambodians, you know, many king, the sort of in, the free, the rebel slave kingdom of Palmares in northern Brazil, lots of places that I think people should know about and can enjoy. Haiti, for example, is a fascinating example, or Hawaii.
Wow.
So, you know, I really took pleasure in covering those sort of places as well.
Haiti was fantastic. I mean, the problem for someone like me, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but perhaps also for you, is you go down a rabbit hole and you can get very easily distracted because suddenly you find yourself so engrossed in the story of Haiti, particularly its foundation, you know, Napoleon's links to that time in French history, the colony itself, these uprisings, the way in that island people, there were the white whites and the black blacks, and then there were the black whites and the white blacks, and it was very, very complicated. And right, the personalities of all these people come, and before you know it, you're reading 7 books about that as well, and now you've lost your way. It must be very disciplined about things.
I'm always losing my way. I'm the greatest for that. I mean, this book is really the result of a thousand trips down rabbit holes. And that's the whole fun. I mean, that's the whole fun of the book. And that's why there are lots of sort of interesting footnotes that have stuff that I just couldn't resist. But it's not just about statesmen and, you know, royal dynasties. There's also, you know, there's also rock stars and mafiosi and architects and artists and poets. And it's got a lot of dark matter of history, but it's also a celebration of sort of human ingenuity and joy and creativity and sex and love and all of that, music.
Well, the Habsburgs are in a few more than one chapter. And really, I mean, they lasted a very long time as a family, didn't they? But you've got the Kims, you know, the Kims in North Korea. You've got some others in Ghana, Sadat in Jerusalem. I mean, there's some amazing, amazing stories here.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's got a lot of the families of today and it's got a lot of the situations of today, but it's also, you know, goes right back to the Medicis and the Borgias and the Caesars. It's all there. And I think, as I said, it's a sort of indictment of humanity, but also a great celebration. And I hope you all enjoy it.
Well, I can't think of a better note to end it on than that. Simon, it's such a great pleasure to speak to you again. Really, the warmest of congratulations on writing such an incredible work, and I hope that many people will take to this as their first journey into history, because it does, as you say, come to you from wherever you may be. You don't need to be a historian to enjoy this book, and the stories in it will inspire many more people to write many more books, I should think.
Thank you. And it's great to talk to you again. More
Thank you.
soon.
Yes, absolutely. Lovely to speak to you. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Same to you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. CliffCentral.com.